Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open with some national news from Public News Service on the latest on the campaign trail and Donald Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis and transparency issues that's raising. Then we'll have an update on California wildfires, followed by part two of our San Diego Supervisor Forum, District 2, with Joel Anderson and Steve Voss. And then we'll have an interview with Pastor Travis Ferguson, who was mentoring the folks during the La Mesa riot. And finally, now that we're into October, we'll have some chilling and thrilling East County Halloween ghost stories. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
He's come down with coronavirus, and a number of his associates have as well. And it just doesn't seem especially surprising to the voters, and it's just not inciting the sympathy that I think would otherwise exist.
Pollster Matt McDermott with Whitman Insight Strategies on this weekend's polls. Former Vice President Joe Biden is still leading President Donald Trump by double digits. In a Reuters and Ipsos poll, 65% of respondents believe Trump could have taken precautions to avoid the virus. That included about half of the Republicans who responded.
This was just bound to happen. I mean, we've all seen the videos for months now of him holding White House events, him holding indoor rallies, him holding indoor fundraisers, where no one's wearing a mask, everyone's sitting close together.
On Sunday, the president took a brief motorcade outside Walter Reed National Military Medical Center to wave to supporters. White House physician Dr. Sean Conley explains the seemingly contradictory information he gave that the president is recovering well while also being treated with medicines usually reserved for serious conditions.
I was trying to reflect the upbeat attitude that the team, the president, that his course of illness has had.
Conley forecasted a possible return to the White House as early as today, but health experts say that doesn't mean the president is out of the woods. Dr. Ingrid Katz with Harvard's Medical Center and Global Health Institute talks about the president's combination of treatments, an experimental, quote, antibody cocktail, antiviral remdesivir, and dexamethasone, a steroid.
Those are generally reserved for people who require respiratory support to breathe, so require supplemental oxygen. And that is an indication that he has at least moderate, if not severe, COVID. And so I think that these are increasingly concerning signs about the severity of his illness.
More than 10 other people in Trump's orbit have also tested positive. The RNC chair, a top aide, a White House staffer, his campaign manager, advisor Kellyanne Conway, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, three Republican senators, Mike Lee, Ron Johnson, and Tom Tillis. Eight of those traced back to the president's in-person Supreme Court announcement of Judge Amy Coney Barrett last week. Cleveland also reported 11 new cases stemming from people who helped set up last week's debate. Trump's public events are canceled for the foreseeable future. Vice President Mike Pence continues to campaign. He debates vice presidential candidate Senator Kamala Harris in Salt Lake City Wednesday night. Now, some Harris supporters are suggesting the senator follow Jamie Harrison's example. This weekend, the Democratic candidate from South Carolina brought his own plexiglass divider to debate longtime Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
I am taking it seriously. That's why I put this plexiglass up, because, you know, it's not just about me. It's about the people in my life that I have to take care of as well. My two boys, my wife, my grandmother.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on the wildfires burning statewide. More than 4 million acres have been ravaged by wildfires in California so far this year, more than double the previous all-time record, and it's only the first week of October. Over 8,300 fires have been tallied in 2020 so far, killing 31 people and destroying over 8,600 structures. More than 16,000 firefighters continue to battle 23 major wildfires across our state. Over the weekend, 26 new fires began, but fortunately all but one of those new fires have been fully contained. The largest wildfire in California history, the August Complex Fire, has burned over 1 million acres. It's burning across several Northern California counties and Mendocino National Forest, but it is 54% contained. That's the good news. 5 of California's worst fires ever have occurred this year as the impacts of climate change become evident in longer, hotter, drier fire seasons that are now virtually year-round. Other devastating fires continue to burn. They include the Zog Fire in Shasta County, which has killed 4 people but is now 76% contained. The Glass Fire in Napa and Sonoma counties is 30% contained after destroying many structures and devastating wineries' crops. The Creek Fire in Fresno County has burned 852 structures down and caused heavy tree damage in Sierra National Forest, burning more than 322,000 acres there, and it's 48% contained. Other fires continue to burn in Yosemite, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon National Parks and federal forest lands, our state treasures, though firefighters are making good progress. In Southern California, the Bobcat Fire in Los Angeles County has burned 115,000 acres, but it's 88% contained, though some evacuations remain in place. The Snow Fire in Riverside County, west of Palm Springs, is 95% contained after burning over 6,200 acres. The Apple Fire, also in Riverside County, is 90% contained and burned over 33,000 acres. The El Dorado Fire in San Bernardino County is 93% contained after it destroyed 10 homes, 22,000 acres, and took a life. Temperatures will remain warm this week across the state, although a chance of rain late in the week could bring some relief to beleaguered firefighters in Northern California. But here in Southern California, gusty winds are forecast across our Southern California mountain ranges, so everyone is asked to please remain vigilant. California historically experiences some of the most devastating wildfires in the months of September and October. To learn how you can prevent sparking a wildfire, please visit readyforwildfire.org. Next up, we have part 2 of our candidate forum with the 2nd Supervisorial District candidates Joel Anderson and Steve Voss. Part 1 was aired on our Friday show, and you can find the full candidate forum on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Let's go to a lightning round now, and we're going to try to do some one-minute answers here and get through the last few questions so we can get in as many from the readers as we can. Supervisors voted a while back to phase out medical cannabis dispensaries in the unincorporated areas. Do you support legalizing the sale of medical, or for that matter, recreational cannabis or other cannabis-related businesses in the unincorporated areas? And let's see, this would be Senator Anderson. You can go first.
So the medical cannabis is very helpful to people, people in pain. The notion that somebody in Ramona has to drive to the city to get access to their medication seems unreasonable to me. I think the cannabis regulations are very strict. You can't be near a school. You have to provide a safe environment. So I'd be very supportive.
Mayor Voss, your response.
If the federal government would remove marijuana from the list of scheduled drugs, I believe there are those that are suffering from diseases that marijuana offers relief, and they should be able to purchase it at their local pharmacy.
Each supervisor has a discretionary fund to spend. Supervisor Jacob largely spent her share of it on parks and trails and libraries. What would your priorities be for that discretionary fund, if there's still any left after all the COVID things? Mayor Voss.
I've sat in on Supervisor Jacob's meetings with folks from the outlying areas who needed funding for parks. And, you know, there's occasionally talk that, you know, it's called a slush fund by some. I disagree that it's a slush fund. I saw how Supervisor Jacob and her staff brought people in and they said, look, we've got this ball field we want to do. We've raised half the money. Can the county match it? I think that's a good approach. I think we could spend more on the arts. The arts have been good for my family. But I would want to look at every opportunity and see where the community has a need and a desire for those funds to go. It's their money.
Yeah, the arts, it's interesting. We're certainly hearing the community theaters are especially hurting, and they've not seemed to get any kind of aid so far. So good point on that. Senator Anderson, how would you spend your discretionary funds as supervisor?
So I'd want to look in the community for the highest and best use, and the community identifying that is the best way to go. I love the arts. I absolutely want to support the arts. In fact, when I was in the legislature, I got $1 million for a museum. What we need to do is reach out to the state. There's all sorts of grants and opportunities to bring more money to San Diego County. I'd hate to use local money for something that the state already has a program for that we've never used. Other counties are pursuing these avenues for additional funds for arts and for other projects. Let's first exhaust those and preserve our money for issues that are facing businesses and individuals, the homeless issue, some of the other issues that really have an impact. When you're driving down some of our county roads where I live, you need to have your tires aligned. The ruts in the road are so great that it makes it very difficult to drive. We need to prioritize meat and potatoes first. I don't think we have to give up on the sweets and all the other items, but I think we can find other revenue sources to backfill it, to enhance it, so that we have more.
Okay, thank you. Can each of you please comment on your views on what factors you would use to evaluate whether or not to approve the two major sand mines that are proposed for El Monte Valley and for along the Sweetwater River at the former Cottonwood Golf site. These are environmentally sensitive areas. One of them actually adjoins a federal wildlife preserve. And on the other hand, we need sand for roadbeds and building. Senator Anderson?
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. The question was about the sand mines proposed for El Monte Valley and Sweetwater. What factors would you use to evaluate whether to determine those? There's certainly balancing, the demand for sand versus the health and environmental concerns.
These issues, there's a lot to them. And I've talked to both sides. And I need to see more data. I actually like to see the studies. Some folks in El Monte say the studies don't go deep enough, that they don't address all the issues. I don't know. And in fairness, I'd want to hear and read and learn more before I made a decision. Both sides have excellent points. I just need to see the data to figure out what's in the best interest of the community.
Mayor Voss.
Well, both need to go through the planning process. I've heard an earful on both sand mining projects. People are fired up about these. And I've met with the other side. I always listen to the people first, especially those that are impacted by a project. If you've ever driven out El Monte Road, I did a few months ago all the way out to El Cap, didn't pass a single car on the way. Now, you imagine that with 193 truck trips, 6 days a week for 25 years. I struggle with that. I'm always going to fiercely advocate for my community. That's my job. I'm there to defend your interests. Sometimes you're going to have to make your voice heard long and loud. Public opposition is often the best way to stop projects that you're opposed to. But we have to remember, it's possible these projects may never even make it to the Planning Commission, let alone to the Board of Supervisors. Only time's going to tell. But to be more direct, if I had to vote today, based on the information I have, I'd have a hard time supporting either one of those.
Let's talk about the county budget and reserves for a moment. I would like to ask if you believe we have adequate reserves, and also next year, as we hopefully finally begin to come out of this pandemic, when there's a vaccine and so forth, what would your number one budget priority be to help lead an economic recovery for the San Diego County region? Mayor Voss, you're the lead off on this one.
Yeah. Up until the pandemic, we had about $700 million in unrestricted reserves. The Board of Supervisors has tapped into that for about $150 million. There's often been talk about reserves. Are they too much? Are they too little? You know, I think they were just about right. Roughly 70 days worth of reserves. Looking forward to, you know, priorities post-pandemic. You know, priorities are priorities because they're important. So my broad priorities are going to be the same as today: public safety, homelessness, and treatment for mental health problems and substance abuse, and continued fiscal discipline. But there's going to be additional areas of focus as a result of the pandemic. For one, I'm going to be looking to our public health officials to be planning ahead for our next health crisis. What have we learned? What should we do differently next time? How can we be more effective? And when it's over, it's going to be critical that we rebuild our reserves. As I said, the board has dipped into them by the tune of $150 million out of about $700 million. We need to restock our reserves so we're ready for the next pandemic or wildfire or earthquake, whatever disaster might befall us.
Thank you. Senator Anderson, your views on whether we have adequate reserves and what you would do to help lead us into an economic recovery after COVID.
When you are facing what we have faced, I don't know that enough money is ever enough to be adequate reserves. Thank God we have as much as we have had so that we can continue. If we were to go back 3 months ago, our priorities probably would be different than what they are today. We don't know when this pandemic is actually going to finish. And I want to survey and figure out where is our highest and best needs. And I would want to address those issues first in order to increase the quality of life in San Diego. You know, we have an incredible community. We've enjoyed an incredible quality of life. And I think it's really important that we do everything in our power to grow it and to move it forward. So I'm not sure what I'd spend without that data, but that's how I'd prioritize.
Thank you. We just have a couple of questions left. We're almost done here, into the home stretch. Ambulance response times in East County are slower than the national standards. What can be done to improve that? I've lost track here.
It's Mr. Anderson. It's,
Steve, I think you're first. No, Joel.
I'll go first. It's my turn.
Joel, you're first.
So, look, there's a lot of things that we can do, but one of the first things is we need to stop converting lanes into bike lanes. Congesting traffic doesn't help response times. It hurts it. And so we need to be thinking in terms of what can we do to get cars off the road and have better response times. I look at East County. We have tremendous opportunities for job and career paths. Every time that we can create a job that takes a car off the road and puts it closer to our homes, one, our families are better because we're home in time to watch our kids play soccer. We can make dinner for our kids. We can do all these wonderful things, and we don't have to take the freeways because we're home and we're close to work. So I think that looking how we move forward will help set that precedent and how we can address it. Some people say, well, we just need more ambulances to address this. I think that we need to think in terms of quality of life. If we're able to free up the lanes to allow and build more lanes to allow people to move throughout the city and throughout the county in a safe manner, that's the best route because it increases our quality of life and it lowers pollution by getting cars off the road.
Okay, thanks for that. Mayor Voss, how would you improve ambulance response times, especially in those rural areas?
This is precisely why I've been fighting so hard to expand the 67 as was promised to voters 16 years ago. When we have a wildfire out in Ramona or Julian or points to the northeast there, the 67 turns into a parking lot. It's known as Blood Alley for a reason. There are problems on that road. We need to expand that highway so not only can people get out, but first responders can get in. Our Poway Fire Department and EMTs are often the ones who respond to emergencies in Ramona. Not to take anything away from the Ramona team, but we're often working up that direction because of mutual aid agreements. So it's critical to have the highway capacity to get folks out, get first responders in, so we can preserve life.
The last question, easy two-parter here for you, would be, Which endorsements are you most proud of? And will you continue Supervisor Jacob's tradition of holding coffees in the communities and over the course of a year, getting out to virtually every town across East County so that everybody gets a chance to meet their supervisor and talk to you directly? Mayor Voss.
I've always had coffees as council member and as mayor. I'll continue to do that. I've covered a lot of the backcountry with Supervisor Jacob participating in her coffees. So yes, I'll continue that. And I've always had my phone number available. As I mentioned before, it's not a shtick. It's the real deal. As far as endorsements, I'm particularly proud of all of them. The majority of the Board of Supervisors, majority of the mayors in the district, majority of the council members in the district, and a bipartisan broad spectrum leaders countywide. Cal Fire Firefighters, Deputy Sheriff's Association, United Domestic Workers, Laborers, Local 89, SEIU. And I'm particularly proud of Father Joe Carroll. He knows a thing or two about homelessness. But the endorsement that I really want is the endorsement of the voters. They're the ones that matter. I'm pleased to be endorsed by over 50 elected leaders from the East County. But the vote that I really want is from the folks.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Anderson, what endorsements are you most proud of? And would you continue those coffees with the community that Supervisor Jacob has started?
Well, I would do it differently than what the supervisor does. She has her meetings in the middle of the day when most people can't attend. I had my meetings when people got off work so more people could attend. It's pointless to go through the motions of having meetings if it's the same 20 people that show up all the time. I want to make sure that everyone has access, and maybe these Zoom meetings might be part of that solution so that more people do have access. But Miriam, you've come to some of my events. Over 5,000 people would show up to give their opinion. In Poway, Steve, you and I, you helped have an event with me, and we had over 100 people show up. Having events in the middle of the day when it's convenient for you but not convenient for the people you represent is not good constituent work. I want the public's input. I want to hear what they have to say. And it's okay if they disagree with me, because I'm always trying to do what's in the best interest of everybody. And I don't always know that answer. So I would have the coffees just like I used to have the coffees. I'll do it again, but I'll do it with higher participation. The second thing, I forgot what you asked me.
Whoops. Endorsements that you're most proud of.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you can go to my website. You can see all the different endorsements I've received. And I'm really proud of them all. But I think what I'm most proud of is the over 4,000 just ordinary Joes, normal citizens who have stepped up and said, Joel, you did a great job. We loved your representation and we want to endorse you again. And you can visit them. You'll see a lot of your neighbors and friends on there. You know, Steve is right. The best endorsement, though, is on election day, and I hope to earn the majority of them, because we deserve better from government. And the person we elect should be working hard to make government work for us. And yet all we hear are slick slogans, but we don't hear real plans. And if we did have those real plans, then just look at your roads. They'd be better. We wouldn't have problems that we're having. Those are indication of how government has failed us. And we deserve better, and we should be demanding better.
Joel, let's hear your closing statements.
It's just this straightforward. If you like visiting your grandkids and your kids out of state or out of this county because we fail to provide jobs and opportunities, we fail to provide quality of life, we fail to provide attainable housing, I'm your guy. If you think this is the best place and it can't be improved, don't vote for me. But I'm going to work hard, just like I did in the legislature, to make government work for you. And I believe that you deserve better. Our homelessness issue is out of control. It's not been addressed in a serious manner that led to outcomes. When you look at how we've approached COVID, we could do so much better if we started using medical science instead of political science to address it. They're not giving us the answers that we want or need because no one's asking the tough questions. Look, I don't want to put anybody's life at risk, but I'm going to ask tough questions because I'm not staff driven. I drove my staff, and if you lived in the 86% of the district that I represented before, you know darn straight I'll come up, knock on your door. You know my number. It's 619-204-2200. It's never changed, and I don't mind you calling if we can fix the problem. And that's what I'm here for. I did 453 bills with Democrats. I'm a Republican, but I understood that if we want to make our community better, we have to work together. And I reached across party lines to lift the tide in the harbor for all boats. We can do this. If we can send a man to the moon, we can sure as heck fix San Diego County, and we deserve it. We've worked hard. We've paid high taxes. Now we need that return on investment, and the county needs to step up. So I'm asking you, I'd like to have your support, and I wish you vote for me, because together we can accomplish everything. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Anderson. And Mayor Voss, it's time for your closing statement.
As supervisor, I'm going to address homelessness by increasing funding for mental health and addiction treatment and implementing effective programs to increase housing for the unsheltered. I'm going to continue Supervisor Jacobs' fight against East County being a dumping ground for sexually violent predators. We can do all of this and more. We can still maintain a fiscally responsible budget. I'm proud of the support that I have from East County leaders. And I'm proud of my record as mayor. In my city, we've expanded open space. We're building more affordable housing for the developmentally disabled and for senior veterans.
I'm still listening. Go ahead.
And we work hard to keep our city safe from wildfires. I work across party lines to get things done. That's exactly how I'll approach my work as East County Supervisor. I will always put people before politics. I would welcome your support. I'd love to have your vote on Election Day or starting October 5th. When voting starts, I invite you to visit my website, vossforsupervisor.com. That's V like victory, A-U-S for supervisor.com. Thanks for being with us tonight. And thank you, Miriam and John, for all your hard work to pull this off.
Well, you're welcome. I really want to thank both candidates for participating tonight and being willing to answer the questions in this time of COVID. I know it's tough to get out and knock on doors if anyone would even answer them with the pandemic. So we thank you. I thank everyone who sent in these great questions. And also I want to thank the Facebook Journalism Project for funding our series of virtual candidate forums in the COVID era so that voters can hear directly from the people that want to represent them. If you missed or tuned in late, folks, on the Facebook live stream, we will be within a couple of days posting the video of the forum on our website at eastcountymagazine.org, where we've got all kinds of information on these candidates and others. We'll be airing an audio version of it on KNSJ Radio, 89.1 FM. If you're not sure if you're registered to vote, be sure to go to sdvote.com. Check and make sure you're still registered. Register to vote if you're not. And we hope you'll make an informed decision on Election Day. And thank you for joining us on our East County Magazine Supervisor Candidates Forum for District 2.
Thanks, Miriam.
Good night.
Thank you.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. East County Magazine's Brianna Gomez spoke with Pastor Travis Ferguson. He has served as police chaplain in Missouri during the Ferguson Uprising and recently ventured out in La Mesa to bring spiritual support to people on the streets during a night of rioting after an earlier peaceful protest.
On May 30th and 31st,
Brianna asked Pastor Ferguson, how can communities so deeply divided come together in these times?
One of the things that always helps me as a Christian, and I think Muslims and Jews would all agree with this statement, is that we're all created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. Genesis says that. If everyone's created in the image of God, then that means I need to be able to treat everyone like I would treat God. And I miss the mark on that constantly. I miss that in my marriage. I miss it in the way I treat my coworkers and the way I treat others. But that's what I want to strive for. And if we can gather around that idea, even if people don't believe in God, mm-hmm. and they can agree with the fact that we all were formed in the same way, mm-hmm. if we can even go back to that,
right?
I think we can have that opportunity to see ourselves as equals rather than as being separate from one another. Mm. You know, the color of our skin should be valued because in some ways it tells the story of our history, right? But I don't identify as a white man. I identify as a man. One of my favorite movies is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Oh, with Sidney Poitier.
Right, and Spencer Tracy. And Sidney Poitier is talking to his dad, and he said, "The problem with you, Dad, is that you identify solely as a black man. I identify as a man." And there's just something so powerful in that statement, because he's not saying that he's not black. He knows the color of his skin, but he's saying that there is something that connects him with everyone else on so much of a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could get to that point as a society, not abandon our heritage, not rid ourselves of the past or the beauty of our skin color, but say, like, there is something great that brings us together, I think there's healing in that. And I think of that I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King. Everyone's heard it, right? Mm-hmm. That little black boys and little white boys can one day be together. The only thing that can make that happen is our desire to make it happen. And maybe protests will do that. But I think at the end of the day, it's simply being able to look at each other with eyes of respect and love, and to value people based on their character.
Just another question, you know, when you were there, there were these looters. Did you feel that they were the same people that were at the protest, or did you feel that people were just seizing the opportunity to kind of get in on the action? And
I think it's a both and. I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
But it's hard not to think that some of the people who looted were brought in, because the thing that can detract from a movement is what happened that night. I think the Black Lives Matter movement knows that. So I'm sure there were some who just seized the opportunity, sure. But I don't think it was the majority.
Yeah.
Looting and rioting is the language of the unheard. I don't think it will help. Mm-hmm. Like, looting and rioting, if anything, deters moving forward, because sure. People then view each other as even worse.
Right.
And it makes us think, well, that's why I have the prejudices I right. do. Look at what they're doing. And that's a terrible way to think, but that's how we often do it. When one or two people mm-hmm. start becoming violent, from the police perspective, you're looking at this as a crowd of people. And so you can't just walk in and take one out sure. without the fear of, is there somebody else there who might hurt me? And so they use the less than lethal method mm-hmm. in an effort to disperse the crowd. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, things spiral out of control at right. that point. And I know that the things that happened were very unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an article for another time.
Yeah.
It's one of the de-escalation techniques in that.
Do you think that it was mishandled, though, from a police perspective, having worked with police?
You know, I don't know. I feel like that would almost be me trying to play Monday morning quarterback. and especially with me not being there on uh-huh. either side at that time, uh-huh. it would be hard for me to make an accurate statement.
Sure.
So I'd prefer not to.
Yeah, no problem.
But peaceful protesters have a right to peacefully protest. Based off what I know from most police departments, they don't use those type of means if there's not a threat of violence.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza-Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery, and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thieves survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tale of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had 3 ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around. But he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost a million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Cahuilla Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Cahuillas began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Cahuilla did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancera, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it, perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994 when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wildcat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wildcats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brooke, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail.
In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Kauai Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head, and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. "I sure froze in my tracks," she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingson, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!